nugget.
Call this one Wells, this one Carver. One of the stevedores glanced around. You got a quarrel with Francis Carver?
No, no.
Balfour shook his head. Quarrel with a man called Wells? Balfour sighed.
No, there hasn't been a quarrel, he said. I'm wanting to find out a thing or two, that's all. But quiet, on the sly.
The gull returned. The stevedore swiped again and missed.
Foul hook through his wing, nearly, said the second man. That's five.
Balfour saw that they had dropped a square of biscuit on the gravel below. The stevedore who had spoken first nodded his head at Balfour and said,
Are you wanting to chase up Carver or chase up the other one?
Neither, Balfour said.
Never mind, never mind. I've got no quarrel with Francis Carver. You remember that? I'll remember, said the stevedore. And then, I say, though, if you're wanting dirt, and on the sly, you ought to ask the jailer.
Balfour was watching the gull circle closer.
The jailer? Shepherd? Why?
Why? Because Carver did time under Shepherd, said the stevedore. On Cockatoo Island, for all of 10 years. Carver dug the dry dock there, convict labour, with Shepherd looking on. If you're wanting dirt on Carver, I'd make a bet that Gov Shepherd is the man to dig it up.
At Cockatoo? Balfour said with interest. I didn't know Shepherd was a sergeant at Cockatoo.
He was. And then the very year after Carver gets his leave, Shepherd gets a transfer to New Zealand and follows him. How's that for bad luck?
The worst, agreed his fellow. How do you know this? Balfour said.
The stevedore was addressing his mate.
That's a face I'd never want to see again. My jailer, day in and day out for 10 years, and then as soon as I'm free.
How do you know this?
Balfour persisted.
I apprenticed on the dockyards there, the stevedore said. Aye, now, that's a conker!
For he had struck the gull across the back with his stick.
You don't happen to know what Carver was booked for, do you, lad?
Trafficking,
the stevedore said immediately.
Trafficking what?
Opium.
What? Into China? Or out?
Couldn't tell you.
Who booked him, though? Not the Crown.
The stevedore thought about this and then shrugged.
I don't really know, he said. I thought it was something to do with opium, but maybe that was just something I heard.
Presently, Balfour bid them both goodbye and moved along the spit. As soon as he was well alone, he planted his feet apart, thrust his hands into his pockets, and looked out over the white roar of the ocean, past the screwjacks and greased rollers, past the wooden lighthouse at the spit's far end, past the dark hulks of the ships that had foundered on the bar.
See now, he muttered to himself. That's something. There's something all right. Carver must be the man's real name. He can't be using an alias. Not in Hokitika under the jailer's own nose, when he served time beneath the man in a penitentiary.
Balfour slicked his moustache with his finger and thumb.
Here's the rub, though. What in heaven's name provoked him to make the claim, with proof in writing to boot, that his name was Francis Wells?
Saturn in Libra, in which Joseph Pritchard outlines his theory of conspiracy, George Shepherd makes a calculated offer, and Harold Nielsen agrees in a tone of remonstration to pay a call upon R. Quay. It was at this point that Balfour's role as narrator was usurped, a transferal that was marked on the shipping agent's part by the lighting of a new cigar, the filling of a fresh glass, and an enthusiastic,
"Now correct me if I'm wrong, boys!"
This exhortation was apparently directed at two persons, Joseph Pritchard, the dark-haired man on Moody's left, whose stifled intensity of silence was matched, as Moody soon discovered, by the stifled intensity of his unhurried speech, and another man whose physical presence we have not yet had cause to remark. This second man had been playing at billiards when Moody first made his entrance. Balfour now introduced him, with an admiring thrust of his cigar, as Harold Nielsen, born in Oslo, late of Bath, undefeated master of the three-card brag, and a damned fine shot, To which Nielsen added, springing forward to augment his own commendation, that he carried a muzzle-loading Enfield musket, the British Empire's finest, and the only firearm he had ever deigned to touch. These two men were more than willing to take Balfour's exhortation at face value. Nielsen, for reasons of vanity, if he could not bear to be the leading role in a sensational tale, and not the leading actor, too, and Pritchard for reasons of precision. We shall therefore leave Thomas Balfour standing on the wharf with his hands in his pockets, squinting into the rain. We shall turn our gaze some 200 yards to the north and alight at the auction yards on Gibson Quay, where, behind the rostrum, an unpainted door leading to a private office bears the legend Nielsen & Co. Commission Merchants. In deference to the harmony of the turning spheres of time, we shall resume our tale exactly at the moment Balfour left off, in Hokitika, on Saturday the 27th of January, at 1:05 in the afternoon. At midday on a Saturday, Harold Nielsen could usually be found in his office, sitting before a stack of contracts, wills, and bills of lading, patting his breast every 10 minutes or so to check again the silver pocket watch that would release him to his luncheon, which he took with medical regularity each day at the Nonpareil. Nielsen recommended this routine to any who would listen, believing very stoutly in the curative properties of dark gravy, pastry, and ale. He did much recommendation, in fact, and often made an example of his own customs for the profit of other, less visionary men. He derived an especial pleasure from argument, so long as it was of the preposterous, hypothetical variety, and so loved to fashion absurd theories of abstraction from the small but dedicated circle of his own tastes. This attitude was affectionately reinforced by his friends, who thought him vivacious and amusing, and scorned by his detractors, who thought him affected and self-absorbed. But these latter voices were subdued in Nielsen's ears, and he spent no effort to better make them out. Harold Nielsen was famous in Hokitika for the high style of his dress. That afternoon he was wearing a knee-length frock coat with silk-faced lapels of a charcoal hue, a dark red vest, a grey bow tie, and cashmere-striped morning trousers. His silk hat, which was hanging on a hat-stand behind his desk, was of the same charcoal hue as his coat. Beneath it was propped a silver-tipped stick with a curved handle. To complete this costume, for so he perceived of his daily dress, as a costume that could be completed to effect, he smoked a pipe, a fat calabash with a bitten-down stem, though his affection for the instrument had less to do with the pleasures of the habit than for the opportunity for emphasis it provided. He often held it in his teeth unlit, and spoke out of the corner of his mouth, like a comic player delivering an aside, a comparison which suited him. For if Nielsen was vain of the impressions he created, it was because he knew that he created them very well. Today, however, the mahogany bowl was warm, and he was pulling on the stem with considerable agitation. The hour of his luncheon was past, but he was not thinking of his stomach, and nor of the ruddy-cheeked barmaid at the Nonpareil, who called him Harry and always saved the choicest edges of the pie-crust for his plate. He was frowning down at a yellow bill upon his desktop, and he was not alone. At length he pulled the pipe from his teeth and lifted his eyes to meet the gaze of the man sitting opposite him. He said in a low voice, "I've done no wrong. I've done nothing below the law." He spoke with only a very slight Norwegian accent. 30 years in Bath had made him all but British in his inflections. "It's who stands to profit," said Joseph Pritchard. "That's what a justice will be looking for. Seems you made a very tidy profit by this man's death."
"By the legal sale of his estate, which I took on after he was already in the ground."
"In the ground, but warm, I think."
"Crosby Wells drank himself to death," said Nielsen. "There was no cause for an inquest, nothing untoward. He was a drunk and a hermit, and when I received these papers I believed his estate would be small. I had no idea about the bounder."
"You're saying this was just a lucky piece of business?"
"I'm saying I've done nothing below the law."
"But someone has," Pritchard said. "Someone is behind this. Who knew about the bounder?
Who waited till Crosby Wells was 6 feet deep, then sold off his land so quiet and so quick, without ever going to auction? Who put his papers in? And who planted my laudanum under his cot?
You say planted?
It was planted, Pritchard said. I'll take my oath on that. I never sold that man a dram. I know my faces, Harold. I never sold a single dram to Crosby Wells.
Well then, there you are. You can prove that. Show your records and receipts.
We have to look beyond our own part in this design, Pritchard said. When he spoke vehemently, he did not raise his voice but lowered it. We're associated. Trace it back far enough, and you'll find an author. It's all of a piece.
Do you suggest this was planned in advance?
Pritchard shrugged. Looks like murder to me, he said.
A conspiracy to murder,
Nielsen corrected him. What's the difference?
The difference is in the charge. It would be conspiracy to murder. We'd be convicted for the intention, not for the act itself. Crosby wasn't killed by another man's hand, you know.
So we've been told, Pritchard said. Do you trust the coroner, Mr. Nielsen? Or will you take a spade in your own hands and bring the hermit's body up?
Don't be ghastly.
I'll tell you this. You'd find more than one corpse in the hole.
Don't, I said.
Emery Staines, Pritchard said relentlessly. What the devil happened to him if he wasn't killed? You think he turned to vapour?
Of course not.
Wells died, Staines vanished, all in a matter of hours. Wells is buried 2 days later, and what better place to hide a body than in another man's grave?
Joseph Pritchard always sought the hidden motive, the underlying truth. Conspiracy enthralled him. He formed convictions as other men formed dependencies. A belief for him was as a thirst, and he fed his own convictions with all the erotic fervour of the willingly confirmed. This rapture extended to his self-regard. Whenever the subterranean waters of his mind were disturbed, he plunged inward and struggled downward, kicking strongly, purposefully, as if he wished to touch the mineral depths of his own dark fantasies, as if he wished to drown.
Nielsen said, "That's useless speculation." "Buried together," said Pritchard. He sat back. "I'd bet my life."
"What does it matter what you guess, what you wager?" Nielsen burst out. "You didn't kill him. You didn't murder anybody. It's on another man's head."
"But somebody certainly wants to make it seem as if I did. And if somebody certainly made you look like a damned fool for chasing a herring that turned out to be red..."
"You're talking appearances."
"Juries care about appearances."
"Come," said Nielsen, somewhat weakly. "You can't really think that a jury..."
"Will be necessary. Don't be an ass. Emery Staines is Hocketeeker royalty. Strange as that sounds, folk who couldn't pick the commissioner from a line-up of drunks know Staines' name. There's no doubt there'll be an inquest. If he fell down the stairs and broke his neck with a dozen men to witness, there would be an inquest. All it's going to take is one shred of evidence to connect him to the Crosby Wells affair, his body probably, whenever they find it, and bang, you're implicated. You're a co-conspirator. You're on trial. And then what are you going to say to defend yourself?"
"That I'm not... that we didn't conspire..."
But uselessness overcame him, and he did not go on. Pritchard did not interrupt the silence. He stared intently at his host and waited. At length Nielsen resumed, struggling to keep his voice calm and practical.
"We mustn't keep anything back. We must go to the justice ourselves."
"And risk the charge." Pritchard's voice became lower still. "We don't know half the players, man. If Staines was murdered,
Look, even if you don't believe the rest of what I'm saying, you must admit that it's a damned coincidence he disappeared when he did. If he was murdered, and let's say he was, well, somebody in town has got to know about it.
Nielsen tried to be haughty. I, for one, am not going to stand about and wait with a noose around my neck.
I'm not proposing that we stand about and wait.
The commission merchant sagged a little.
What then?
Pritchard grinned.
You say there's a noose. Well, all right. Follow the rope.
Back to the banker, you mean?
Charlie Frost, maybe.
Nielsen looked sceptical.
Charlie's no double-crosser. He was as surprised as anyone when the bounder turned up.
Surprised? That's easy to fake. And what about the fellow who purchased the land? Clinch, of the Gridiron Hotel. He must have been tipped off somehow.
Nielsen shook his head. I can't believe it.
Perhaps you ought to try.
Anyway, Nielsen said, frowning, Clinch doesn't stand to gain a penny now that the widow's made her claim. She's the one you should be worried about.
But Pritchard did not have an opinion about the widow.
Clinch doesn't stand to gain a penny from Crosby Wells, maybe, he said. But think on this. Staines leases the Gridiron to Clinch, doesn't he?
What are you driving at?
Only that a fellow's never sorry when his creditor is dead.
Nielsen turned red.
Clinch wouldn't take another man's life. None of them would. Charlie Frost, come off it, Joe, the man's a mouse.
You can't tell from looking at a man what he's capable of doing. And you certainly can't tell what he's done.
This kind of speculation, Nielsen began, but he did not know what form his protestation was to take, and he again fell silent.
Nielsen did not know the vanished prospector, Emery Staines, at all well, though if asked, he would have declared the opposite, for Nielsen tended to profess intimacy whenever it flattered him to do so, and Staines was very much the kind of man with whom Nielsen would have liked to forge an intimate acquaintance. Nielsen loved to be dazzled, and never was he more dazzled than by the selfhood of a man he very much admired. Emery Staines, being possessed of both youth and conviction, was naturally an enviable type. Calling him to mind now, Nielsen had to agree with Pritchard that it was exceedingly unlikely that Staines had departed Hokitika in secret, of his own volition, in the middle of the night. His claims required constant maintenance and supervision, and there were more than 50 men in his employment. Why, his absence would be costing more than pennies, Nielsen thought, and the debt would be mounting every day. No, Pritchard was right. Staines had either been kidnapped or, far more likely, he had been killed, and his body had been very effectively concealed. The current information held that Emery Staines had last been seen around sundown on the 14th of January, walking south down Revel Street in the direction of his house. What happened after that, nobody knew. His barber came calling at 8 the next morning and found his door unlocked. He reported that the bed was rumpled, as if recently slept in, but the fire was cold. All valuables were present and untouched. Emery Staines had no enemies, as far as Nielsen was aware. His disposition was bright and very open, and he had the rare gift of managing to act both generously and humbly at once. He was very rich, but there were many rich men in Hokitika, and most of them were a good deal more unpleasant than he. It was unusual that he was young, of course, and that might be a cause for envy in an older, more disappointed man. But envy was rather a weak motive for murder, Nielsen thought, if indeed the young man had been killed.
What would drive any man to quarrel with Staines? Nielsen said aloud. That boy radiates luck. The Midas touch he has.
Luck is not a virtue.
Killed for his money, then?
Let's put Staines aside for the moment.
Pritchard leant forward.
You took home a fair cut of Crosby Wells' fortune.
Yes, I told you, 10%, Nielsen said, turning back to the yellow bill of sale on the desk before him. Commission on the sale of his effects, you know. But now that the will's been disputed, the payment's void.
I shall have to pay it all back again. The property ought not to have been sold." He touched the edge of the bill with his finger. He had signed the document and its copy at this very desk 2 weeks prior, and how his heart had sunk as he had penned his name. In Hokitika, the sale of effects on a deceased estate was never a profitable venture, but his business was not prospering, and he was desperate. How shameful it was, he had thought, to have travelled half the girth of the globe only to see his fortunes fall so far, only to scrabble for scraps beneath the tables of richer, luckier men. The name on the bill, Crosby Wells, had meant nothing to him. From what he knew, Wells was just a loner, a wretched twist of a man who drank himself into a stupor every night and dreamed of nothing. Nielsen signed his name in bitterness, in exhaustion. He was going to have to rent a horse, sacrifice a day of work, ride out, where? To the forsaken Arahura, and pick over this dead man's effects as a vagrant trawls through a gutter looking for food. And then, wedged into the flour canister, the powder box, the meat safe, the bellows, the cracked basin of an old commode, and all of it glistering, heavy and soft. His commission had come in at just over £400. For the first time in his life, he was flush. He might have packed up and sailed to Sydney. He might have returned home. He might have begun anew. He might have married. But he had no time to enjoy it. The day his commission was finally cleared was the very day of Mrs. Wells' arrival. Within hours, the sale of the estate had been appealed, the inheritance disputed, and the fortune seized by the bank. If the appeal was granted, as it certainly would be, Nielsen would be obliged to pay his commission back again in full. £400! It was more money than he earned in a year. He ran his finger down the edge of the bill and felt a lonely stab of outrage. He wished, as he had wished many times in the last week, that he could be given someone to blame. But Pritchard was shaking his head. He wasn't interested in the dead man's will, nor in the legal implications of its contest. "Never mind all that for the moment," he said. "Think back to the cottage. You saw the pile with your own eyes."
"I was the one to discover it," Nielsen spoke with a touch of pride. He relaxed a little at the memory. "Oh, if you'd seen it, I might have turned it into leaf and covered a whole billiard table, legs and all, heavy as anything, and how it shone."
Pritchard didn't smile. "You said that it wasn't dust and it wasn't nugget. Do I have that right?"
Nielsen sighed. "Yes, that's right. It had all been pressed into squares."
"Retorted," Pritchard said, nodding, "which takes equipment and skill. So who was the smith? Not Wells himself."
Nielsen paused. This was a point that had not crossed his mind. The way that Pritchard was setting forth his argument, confidently, arrogantly, was unpleasant to him, but he had to concede that the chemist had made several connections already that he himself had missed. He sucked on his pipe. Nielsen had no great knowledge of the workings of a goldfield. He had only attempted to prospect for the colour once, and found it miserable work, lugging pails of water to and from the river to sluice the stones, slapping at the sandflies that crept up his jacket until he was mad enough to dance. Afterwards his back ached, and his fingers stung, and his feet stayed spongy and swollen for days. The pinch of grit he had taken home, knotted into the corner of his kerchief, was taxed and taxed, and then weighed to the smallest fraction of an ounce, yielding at last 5 dirty shillings, an impossible disappointment, barely enough to cover the rental of his horse to and from the gorge. Nielsen did not try his luck again. He was by natural faculty and self-styling a Renaissance man, accustomed to showing immediate promise in whatever field to which he applied himself. If he did not master a trick on his first attempt, he gave up the trade. He was not without humour about this practice. He often recounted his abortive episode in the Hokitika Gorge, exaggerating the discomforts he had sustained in light-hearted deprecation of his own constitutional delicacy. But this was an interpretation that was reserved for him alone. and he became embarrassed if another man took on this same perspective, so to speak, or agreed with him. The theory that Joseph Pritchard had put to him was logical enough, up to a point. Somebody, more than one person perhaps, must have known about the fortune hidden on Crosby Wells' estate. The fortune was too large, and the sale of his property too furtive and too swift to deny that probability altogether. Furthermore, the phial of laudanum that had been discovered in close proximity to the man's dead body suggested that somebody, perhaps the same somebody, had been present in the cottage either just prior to or just after the hermit's death, presumably with some intention of harm. The phial was Pritchard's, purchased from his emporium and bearing a label signed in his hand. Its bearer must therefore have been a Hokitika man travelling northward, not a stranger travelling south. This ruled out the dignitaries who had first discovered Crosby's body and had brought the news of his death to the town. Privately, Nielsen did believe that Pritchard was right to hold the purchaser of the estate, Edgar Clinch, in suspicion, and the banker, Frost, as well. He did not suspect them of having a part in Emery Stain's murder, as Pritchard evidently did, but it seemed to him that Clinch must have acted on a tip of some kind, to buy Crosby Wells' cottage and land so hastily, and whatever that tip might have been, Charlie Frost must know about it. Nielsen could also accept that his own involvement, however innocently undertaken, must look decidedly fishy to an impartial outsider. He had been the one to discover the fortune, after all. He had recorded the glass phial of laudanum in his ledger along with everything else. He had been compiling a list of effects to be sold, and he stood to gain £400 out of the transaction. Beyond these admissions, however, which after all were only admissions of doubt and probable impression, Nielsen was uncertain. Pritchard had reasoned that the disappearance of Emery Staines could not be coincidental, which was supposition. He had argued that the man had been murdered, which was guesswork. He had suggested that his body had been buried in Wells' own grave, which was presumption. And he had proposed that the legal debacle over Wells' estate had been planned in advance as a kind of eclipse, a decoy. This last, Nielsen thought, was downright fantasy. Pritchard could not account for the phial of laudanum. He could not produce a motivation or a plausible suspect. And yet the commission merchant could not discount the man's convictions altogether, however much he disliked the manner in which they were expressed. Nielsen did not share the chemist's rapt intoxication with the plumbing of the deep. The quest for truth did not possess him as it did his guest. Pritchard became very strange when speaking of his passions, the elixirs that he brewed and tasted under the low ceiling of his laboratory, the resins and powders that he bought and sold in clouded jars. There was something cold and hard about the man, Nielsen thought, diverting his own ill-feeling, as he often did, into a principle of aesthetic distaste. At last, and with the air of vexation that always passed over him whenever another man's argument showed a deficiency in his own, Nielsen took his pipe from his mouth and said, "Well, perhaps Wells had a contact down at the reserve. Killarney, or a company man." "No." Pritchard struck the desk with splayed fingers. He'd been waiting for Nielsen to guess wrongly, and he had his counter-argument prepared. "This is a Chinaman's work. I'd bet any money." The joss at Kawarau was always full of fellows without a permit. They shared the miners' rights between them. No man can tell two of them apart, you see. And one name's as good as another when it comes from a foreign tongue. It's all outside jobs in Chinatown. If this was a company affair, it would look cleaner? Nielsen sounded hopeful. "The opposite. When a fellow has to cover his prints, when he has to use the tradesman's entrance instead of coming in through the foyer as he's known to do, that's when he has to start making provisions, sacrifices. Do you see? A man on the inside has to contend with the pawns, with all the pieces of the system, but a man on the outside can deal with the devil direct." It was expressions of this kind that Nielsen particularly disliked. He dropped his gaze again to the bill of sale. "Chinatown Forge," Pritchard said. "You mark my guess. One fellow does all the furnace work. His name is Quee.
You'll speak to him, said Nielsen, looking up.
Actually, said the chemist, I was hoping that you would. I'm in a spot of bother with the Orientals at the moment.
Dare I ask why?
Oh, bad business is all. Trade secrets. Opium, Pritchard said. He turned his hand over and then let it fall into his lap. Nielsen frowned.
You ship your opium from China?
Good Lord, no, Pritchard said. From Bengal. He hesitated a moment. It's more of a personal dispute. On account of the whore who nearly died.
Anna, Nielsen said. Anna Wetherill.
Pritchard scowled. He had not wanted to use her name. He turned his head away and watched the raindrops swell and gather under the lip of the sash window. In the brief pause before he resumed speaking, Nielsen was startled by the thought that perhaps the chemist loved her. Anna Wetherill, the whore. He tested the possibility in his mind, enjoying it. The girl was uncommonly striking. She moved with a weary, murderous languor, like a disaffected swan. But she was rather more volatile in her tempers than Nielsen liked in a girl. And her beauty, in fact, Nielsen would not call her beautiful, he reserved that word for virgins and angelic forms, was too knowing for his taste. She was also an opium eater, a habit that showed in her features as a constant blur and in her manner as a fathomless exhaustion. This compulsion was unbecoming enough, and now she was a would-be suicide besides. Yes, Nielsen thought, she was just the kind of girl for whom Pritchard would fall. They would meet in darkness. Their encounters would be feverish and doomed. Here the commission merchant missed his mark. Nielsen's guesses were always of the self-confirming sort. He tended to favour whichever proofs best pleased his sense of principle, and equally to hold fast to whichever principles best lent themselves to proof. He often talked of virtue, and so gave the impression of a most encouraging and optimistic temper. But his faith in virtue was indentured to a less adaptable master than optimism. The benefit of the doubt, to take the common phrase, was a haphazard gift, and Nielsen was too proud of his intellect to surrender the power of hypothesis. In his mind, a protective glaze had been applied to the crystal forms of high abstraction. He loved to regard them, and to wonder at their shine, but he had never thought to take them down from their carved and oaken mantle, so to speak, and feel them, supple in his hands. He had concluded that Pritchard was in love simply because it was pleasant to deliberate the point, examine the specimen, and then return to the beliefs he had possessed all along, that Pritchard was a queer fish, that Anna was a lost cause, and that one ought never undertake to love a whore. Yes, well, Pritchard was saying, they're furious about it, you know. The yellow chap who operates the den at Canyere, Arsouk is his name, he went to Tom Balfour after the whore took ill. Very upset, you understand. He told Tom he wanted to look over my shipping records, check the last case that had come in on my account. Why not just come to you direct? Nielsen asked. Pritchard shrugged. Thought I was up to something, I suppose, he said.
He thought you poisoned her, on purpose.
Yes. Pritchard looked away again.
Well, and what did Tom say?
Nielsen said, to prompt him. He showed Arsouk my records. Proved I'm clean.
Your records clean?
Yes, Pritchard said shortly. Nielsen saw that he had caused his guest offence, and felt an ugly flash of pleasure. He was beginning to resent the implication that they would be equally implicated as conspirators if, or when, the possible murder of Emery Staines came to light. It seemed to him that Pritchard was considerably more embroiled in this mess than he was. Nielsen had nothing to do with opium, and wanted nothing to do with it. The drug was a poison, a scourge, and it made a fool of men. Listen, Pritchard said, placing his finger on the desktop. You need to get this Quee chap to talk with you. I'd do it myself if I could. I've tried the den, but Souk won't have a bar of me. Quee's all right. He's decent. Ask him about the pile. Whether it's his gold, and if it is, why it turned up on Wells' estate. You can go this afternoon. It rankled Nielsen to be ordered about in this way.
I don't see why you can't talk to Quee yourself, if your beef is with the other fellow.
I'm under the hammer. Call it laying low. Nielsen called it something rather different in his mind. Aloud, he said,
What on earth would induce a Johnny Chink to speak to me?
Taking refuge, finally, in petulance. He pushed the yellow bill away from him.
At least you're neutral, Pritchard said. You've given none of them cause to judge you one way or another, have you?
The Celestials?
Nielsen sucked on his pipe. The leaf was almost ash.
No.
You say it with an R in front. Ah, Quee. It's their way of saying Mister. Pritchard paused a moment, regarding the other man, and then he added, Think of it this way. If we are being framed, then perhaps he is too. As he was speaking, there came a knock at the door. It was the clerk, bearing the message that George Shepherd was in the outer office and waiting to be received.
George Shepherd? The jailer?
Nielsen said with some trepidation and a swift glance at Pritchard.
Did he say why? Matter of profit, he said. Mutual gains, the clerk replied. Shall I fetch him in?
I'll take my leave, Pritchard said, standing immediately. So you'll find him, the fellow Quee.
Say you will.
All the way to Canyeri,
Nielsen said, remembering his luncheon and the barmaid at the Nonpareil.
It's only an hour's walk, Pritchard said. But make sure you get the right fellow. The one you're after is a shortish chap, very thin, clean-shaven. You'll know his cottage by the chimney that issues from the forge. I'll wait your message.
And he was gone. Nielsen's office seemed much too small to accommodate the massive, rigid bow that George Shepherd made upon his entrance. The commission merchant felt himself shrink back a little in his chair, and to compensate for this, he leapt up, thrust out his hand, and cried,
Mr. Shepherd, yes, yes, please. I haven't yet had the pleasure of receiving your business, sir. But I do hope that I can be of service in the nearest future, if I may. Do sit down.
I know you, of course, Shepherd replied, taking the chair that was offered him. Seeing that Nielsen's pipe was lit, he reached in his pocket for his own. Nielsen passed his tobacco pouch and lucifers across the desk, and there was a short pause as Shepherd filled and tamped his bowl and struck a match. His pipe was shallow, made of briar, with a smart collar of amber set between the bit and the stem. He puffed several times until he was satisfied the leaf was lit, and then sat back in his chair with a calculated glance first to his left and then to his right, as if he wished to square himself with the planes of the room.
By reputation, he added,
being the kind of man who always finished an utterance once he had set his thought in motion. He breathed out a mouthful.
That fellow just leaving, he said. His name again?
Joe Pritchard is his name, sir. Joseph. Runs the drug hall on Collingwood Street.
Of course.
Shepherd paused, forming his business in his mind. The pale light of the day, falling slantwise across Nielsen's desk, froze the eddies of pipe smoke that hung about his head, fixing each coiling thread upon the air, as mineral quartz preserves a twisting vein of gold and proffers it. Nielsen waited. He was thinking, if I am convicted, then this man will be my jailer. George Shepherd's appointment as governor of the Hokitika jail had been met with little opposition from the men who lived and dug within the bounds of his jurisdiction. Shepherd was a cold, formidable character, slow-moving in a way that seemed constantly to emphasize the breadth of his shoulders and the weight of his arms. When he walked, it was with long, deliberate strides, and when he spoke, which was seldom, he intoned in a rich and august bass. His manner was humorless and not at all likable, but severity counted as a virtue for a man of his profession, and it was to his credit, the voters agreed, that no charge of bias or prejudice had ever been laid at his door. If Shepherd was the subject of idle rumour, It was of the conjectural sort, and nearly always concerned his private relations with his wife. Their marriage was to all appearances conducted in absolute silence, with a grim determination on his part and a fearful inhibition on hers. The woman referred to her own self as Mrs. George, and this only in a whisper. She wore the bewildered, panicked aspect of a tortured animal who sees a cage where there is none and cowers at every sudden thing. Mrs. George rarely ventured beyond the jailhouse door, except on rare occasions of civic display, to trip red-faced down Revel Street in Governor Shepherd's wake. They had been at Hokitika 4 months before anyone discovered that she did in fact possess a Christian name, Margaret, though to speak it in her presence was an assault so dreadful that her only recourse was to flee.
"I come to you on business, Mr. Nielsen," Shepherd began. He held the bowl of his pipe in his fist against his breast as he spoke. "Our present jailhouse is little better than a corral, a holding pen. There is scant light and insufficient air. To ventilate, we prop open the door upon a chain, and I sit beyond the doorway with my rifle on my knees. It is untenable. We haven't the resources to cope with more experienced criminals. More sophisticated crimes. A murder, say."
"No. Yes, yes," Nielsen said. "Of course."
There was a pause, and then Shepherd continued.
"If you will forgive my pessimism," he said, "I believe that Hokitika is about to meet a darker time. This town is at a threshold. Digger law is still the creed of the hills, and here... why, we are but a backwater of Canterbury still, but soon we will be the jewel in her crown. Westland will split, and Hokitika will prosper, but as she rises, she will have to reconcile herself."
Reconcile?
"The savage and the civil," Shepherd said.
"You allude to the natives, the Maori tribes?"
Nielsen spoke with a touch of eagerness. He cherished a romantic passion for what he called the tribal life. When the Maori canoes came strong and flashing through the Bulla Gorge, he had seen them from a distance. He was quelled in awe. The warriors seemed terrible to him, their women unknowable, their customs fearsome and primitive. His transfiction was closer to dread than to reverence, but it was a dread to which he sought to return. In fact, Nielsen had been first spurred to make his voyage to New Zealand by a chance encounter with an able seaman at a roadside inn near Southampton, who was boasting, rather improbably as it turned out, of his own encounters with the primitive peoples of the South Seas. The sailor was a Dutchman and wore his jacket cut short above his hips. He had traded iron nails for coconuts. He had permitted island women to place their hands upon the white skin of his chest. He had once made a present of a knot to an island boy. "What kind of knot?" Nielsen begged, coming forward. It was a Turk's head. Nielsen did not know it, and the seaman sketched the looping floral shape upon the air. But Shepherd shook his head at Nielsen's interjection.
"I do not use savage in the native sense," he said. "I allude to the land itself. Prospecting is an ugly business. It makes a man start thinking like a thief. And here the conditions are foul enough to make the diggers still more desperate."
"But the diggings can be made civil."
"Perhaps, after the rivers are spent, after the prospectors give way to dams and dredges and company mines, when the forests are felled, perhaps then."
"You do not have faith in the power of the law," Nielsen said, frowning. "Westland is soon to have a seat in Parliament, you know."
"I see that I am not making myself clear," Shepherd said. "Will you allow me to begin again?"
"By all means." The jailer began immediately, without altering his posture or his tone.
"When two codes of justice are available at once," he said, "a man will always use the one to inveigh against the other. Consider a man who thinks it just and right to bring a complaint to the magistrate's court against his own whore, expecting both the exercise of the law and his exemption from it. He is refused,
And perhaps he is even charged for consorting with the girl. Now he blames the law and the girl both. The law cannot answer for his digger's sense of what is due, and so he takes the law upon himself and throttles her. In former days he would have solved his quarrel with his fists at once. That was digger's law. Perhaps the whore would perish or survive, but either way, his action was his own. But now he feels his very right to demand justice has been threatened, and that is what he acts upon. He is doubly angry, and his rage is doubly spent. I am seeing examples of this kind every day.
Shepherd sat back and replaced his pipe in his mouth. His manner was composed, but his pale eyes were fixed very intently upon his host. Nielsen never refused an opportunity to provoke a hypothetical.
"Yes, but to follow your argument," he said, "surely you are not suggesting a preference for digger's law?"
"Digger's law is Philistine and base," Governor Shepherd said calmly. "We are not savages. We are civilized men. I do not consider the law to be deficient. I mean to point out merely what happens when the savage meets the civil. 4 months ago, the men and women in my jailhouse were drunks and petty thieves. Now I see drunks and petty thieves who feel indignant and entitled, and speak righteously as if they have been unjustly tried, and they are angry."
"But again, to conclude," Nielsen said, "after the whore is throttled, after the digger's rage is spent, surely the civil law then returns to condemn this man. Surely he's punished justly, in the end."
"Not if his fellows rally round him to preserve his digger's rights," Shepherd replied. "No man holds to any code as strong as he does when his code's affronted, Mr. Nielsen, and there's nothing more brutal than a gang of angry men. I've been a jailer 16 years.
Nielsen sat back in his chair.
"Yes," he said, "I take your point. It's this twilight that's the danger between the old world and the new."
"We must do away with the old," Shepherd said. "I will not suffer whores, and I will not suffer those who frequent them."
Shepherd's autobiography, a document which, if ever penned, would be rigid, admonishing, and frugal, did not possess that necessary chapter wherein the young hero sows his oats and strays. Since his marriage, his imagination had conjured nothing beyond the squarish figure of Mrs. George, whose measures were so familiar and so regular that he might have set his pocket watch by the rhythm of her days. He had always been irreproachable in his conduct, and as a consequence, his capacity for empathy was small. Anna Wetherill's profession did not fascinate him in the least, and he had no boyhood memories of tenderness or embarrassment to soften him towards the subtleties of her trade. When he looked at her, he saw only a catalogue of indiscretions, a volatile intelligence, and a severe want of promise. That a whore might attempt to take her own life did not strike him as a remarkable thing, nor a very sad one. In this particular case, he might even call a termination merciful. Miss Wetherill lived by the will of the dragon, after all, a drug that played steward to an imbecile king, and she would guard that throne with jealous eyes forever. It is fair to say that of the 7 virtues, Governor Shepherd inclined towards the cardinal 4. He was well apprised of the Christian doctrine of forgiveness, but only as a creed to be studied and obeyed. We do not mean to diminish his religion by remarking that forgiveness is a thing that one must first be obliged to ask for in order to know how to give, and Governor Shepherd had never in his life met any imperative to ask. He had prayed for Miss Wetherill's soul, as he did for all the men and women in his keeping, but his prayers were expressions of duty rather than of hope. He believed the soul to inhabit the body, and consequently that the body's desecration was an assault upon the soul. A common whore, when judged by this substantive theology, fared ill indeed, and Anna Wetherill was malnourished, mistreated, and as wretched a picture as any he had seen. He did not wish her damned, but he believed privately that her salvation was impossible. Miss Wetherill's spiritual fate, and the method by which she had sought to determine it forever, did not interest him. Her corporeal merits did not interest him either. In this, Shepherd was set apart from the majority of men in Hokitika, who, as Gascoigne was to remark to Moody some 7 hours later, had been talking of little else for a fortnight. When they exhausted the former subject, they fell back upon the latter, an arrangement that kept them in conversation for a great while. Nielsen's pipe had gone out. He rapped the bowl against his desktop to empty the ash and then began to refill it. "I believe Alistair Lauderback means to make a change," he said, unlacing the strings of his tobacco pouch with his free hand. "If he is selected, of course." Shepherd did not answer at once.
"You've been following the campaigns?"
Nielsen, busy with his pouch, did not notice the other man's hesitation. When the jailer had first entered, Nielsen had been fearful of himself, even guarded, but he rarely dwelled long in a state of embarrassment. Shepherd's theory of law had roused his intelligence and gratified it, and he again felt master of his faculties. The absorbing rituals that attended the filling of his pipe, the worn thinness of the leather strings, the dry spice of the tobacco, had restored a kind of order to his senses. He replied without looking up, "Yes, indeed. Reading the speeches every day, and with keen attention. Lauderback is here now, in Hokitika, is he not?"
"He is," Shepherd said.
"He will take the seat, I think," said Nielsen, rubbing a pinch of tobacco between his fingers. "The Littleton Times is backing his play."
"You value him?"
"Tunnels and railways," Nielsen said. "That's his game, isn't it? Progress, civilization, all of that. Strikes me that your thinking squares quite nicely with Lauderback's campaign."
He struck a match.
Shepherd made to reply, then hesitated.
"I don't make a habit of speaking my politics in another man's office unless I'm invited to do so, Mr. Nielsen."
"Oh, please," said Nielsen politely, shaking out the match.
"But with your leave," nodding his great pale head, "I will say this. I too think that Lauderback will take the seat. Parliament and the super both. He has a great force of personality on his side, and of course his connection to the bar and to the provincial council speak highly of his character and skill."
"And this is a re-election for him, of course," interrupted Nielsen, who very often made a habit of speaking politics in other men's offices, and forgot for a moment that he had granted the other man license to speak his own mind. "He's familiar."
"He is familiar to his own circle," Shepherd said. "His loyalty is to Canterbury, and his tunnels and railways, to take your phrase, are the Littleton Tunnel and the projected railway between Christchurch and Dunedin. As superintendent, he will reapportion whatever funds are not already tied into this tunnel and this railway, as he must, of course, to make good the promises of his campaign."
"You may be right about the super," Nielsen said, "but as an MP, he will represent Westland."
"Lauderback is a Westland man in electorate only," Shepherd said. "I do not fault him on it. He has my vote, Mr. Nielsen. But he does not know the digger's life."
Nielsen looked as if he meant to interrupt again, so Shepherd pressed on, raising his voice a little.
"I arrive now at the business that compelled this interview. I have the commissioner's endorsement to begin work upon a new jailhouse, away from the police camp, on the terrace north of town. You recall it was a company of convicts who first cleared the Hokitika Road. I intend to do the same thing here. I shall use my own convict labour to build the prison at Seaview."
This notion appealed to Nielsen's sense of retribution, and he smiled.
"However, as you have already remarked," Shepherd continued, "Alistair Lauderback's focus is on transport. In his address to the council, he has argued in favour of using convict labour to build and maintain the Christchurch Road. The route over the Alps is still treacherous, unfit for a horseman, much less for a coach."
"The superintendent has the final word on the matter?" Nielsen asked.
Are your convicts not yours to employ?
Alas, Shepherd said, they are only mine to keep.
The clerk entered, bearing coffee on a wooden tray. He was in a state of considerable excitement, for it was not often that Nielsen had visitors, and never visitors of such enigmatic repute as Pritchard, who was famous for his opium, and Shepherd, who was famous for his wife. The clerk had arranged the coffee pot and saucers on the tray with particular attention, and he carried it high with his elbows cocked and his back held very straight. Nielsen nodded approvingly. It was not their custom for the clerk to wait on his employer, but Nielsen was pleased at the effect it must be creating in the mind of his guest. The clerk set the tray upon the sideboard and began to pour. He was hoping that the men would resume their conversation while he was still in the room, and tried to pour slowly, feeling a pang of regret at the floating grains of chicory that he had added to the coffee grounds for reasons of economy, and now, with their ugly film of grit, seemed to admonish his pretensions. Behind him, Shepherd said, "By the by, Mr. Nielsen, what do you know about Emery Staines?" There was a pause. "I know that he is missing," Nielsen responded.
"Missing, yes," said Shepherd. "He hasn't been seen for almost a fortnight." "Very strange."
"I do not know him well," Nielsen said.
"Don't you?" said Shepherd.
"He is an acquaintance, but not a friend."
"Ah."
Nielsen seemed about to cough. Then he burst out, "Are you quite finished, Albert?" The clerk set down the coffee pot. "Shall I leave the tray, sir?" "Yes, yes, then go, for God's sake," Nielsen said. He lurched for the cup as it was handed him, causing a small tide of coffee to slop into the saucer, and set it down before him with a clatter. The clerk brought a second cup to Shepherd, who made no move to touch it, and pointed to the desk before him without a word.
"I shall say it plain," Shepherd said, when the disappointed clerk had shut the door behind him. "I mean to begin work on the jailhouse at once, before the elections, so that when Lauderback takes office, the work is already well underway. I am aware that this may seem to others as if I seek to actively thwart the success of his campaign. I come to you to solicit both your business and your discretion."
"What do you need?" Nielsen said cautiously.
"Materials to build, and perhaps 10 or 20 able bodies to begin digging the foundation," Shepherd said, reaching into his breast for the plans. "I can offer you commission at your standard rate. The site has been purchased already and approved. Here is the architect's design."
"This is the original or a copy?"
Nielsen took the papers from Shepherd's massive hand and unfolded them.
"The original."
"There is no copy," Shepherd said. "I keep these documents on my person always, of course."
"Of course," Nielsen agreed, reaching for his spectacles. "The reason I have come to you," Shepherd continued,
"and not to Cochrane or Morrison or another competitor whose business, forgive me, is faring rather better than yours at present, owes only in part to your reputation as an efficient man."
Nielsen looked up.
"Permit me to speak frankly," Shepherd said. "The matter is indelicate, I know. I will try and be as delicate as I can. It has come to my attention that you took home a commission to the value of many hundreds of pounds upon closing the estate of Mr. Crosby Wells."
Nielsen started, but Shepherd held up his hand to silence him.
"Do not implicate yourself by speaking before you have heard what I have to say," he said. "I will tell you exactly what I know. The man's body came through the police camp before his burial. Given that he had no family or friends to speak of, we conducted the wake at the camp itself. I had the solemn honour of viewing his body and of being present while the physician checked his vital organs for signs of harm. Dr. Gillies concluded the cause of death was drink. I, with my slender knowledge of the subject, could only agree with his ruling. Dr. Gillies was careful in his examination of the contents of the dead man's stomach and intestines, however, which contained not only food and spirits, but traces of laudanum, though not enough, I should add, to warrant undue suspicion. I do not believe that Crosby Wells was poisoned, except by drink. Now, even before the wake was over, Wells' land and mill were sold. The land, as you know, was reclaimed by the bank, and was then purchased almost immediately by a Mr. Edgar Clinch. While the transaction was perfectly legal, it is nevertheless curious how swiftly the property changed hands. I understand that you were then called upon to clear the cottage and sell on the dead man's effects for a fee that would be set against their total value. You accepted this employment and promptly discovered a great deal of hoarded gold. Where was it hidden? In the flower canister, to the aggregate value of £4,000. A homeward bounder, to use the local phrase. Now, Mr. Nielsen, you ought to have then been able to walk away with your percentage, which was by now a very handsome cut. The whole enterprise was thwarted, however, when Mr. Wells' widow landed on the beach and declared herself. She was 1 week too late to attend his burial, but not at all too late to contest the sale of his estate and any transactions that had taken place as a consequence of that sale. As I have said, I do not believe that Crosby Wells was poisoned, Shepherd said, but I also do not believe that the hoarded gold belonged to him, much less to his widow. The apparition of the widow Wells is a curiosity in a tale already rather too curious for my taste. He paused. Have I said anything so far that you know or guess to be untrue? You can decline to answer that if you wish.
You mean to blackmail me? Nielsen managed.
Not at all, Shepherd said. But you must agree this smacks of plotting.
Yes, I do.
I am not a detective, Shepherd said, and profess no inclination towards that field. I care very little about how much you know. But I must have my new jailhouse, and I see an opportunity for both of us to gain.
Speak it, sir.
The widow Wells has made her appeal to contest the sale of her late husband's effects, Shepherd said. The appeal will take months to action, of course, as legal matters do, and in the meantime the money will be held in escrow by the bank. In the end, I expect that the sale will be revoked, and if no greater plot is exposed, the widow will claim the bounder as her own. Incidentally, I have enjoyed several conversations with Crosby Wells these past few months, and he certainly never spoke of being married. Not to me, nor to any other man I've spoken to.
Nielsen had a vision of a cat tapping a small rodent back and forth with the flat of its paw, its claws in sheath.
He was not guilty. He had done no wrong, and yet he felt guilty. He felt implicated, as though he had performed a terrible misdeed while sleeping and had woken to find his bolster smeared with blood. He felt certain that any moment now the jailer would expose him, but for what crime he did not yet know. What was the word Pritchard had used? Associated. Yes, he felt that acutely.
When he was a small boy, Nielsen had stolen a precious button from his cousin's treasure chest. It was a cuff button from a military jacket, brass in colour, and engraved with the lithe body of a fox, running forward with its jaws parted and its ears cocked back. The button was domed, and greyer on one side than on the other, as if the wearer had tended to caress its edge with his finger, and over time had worn the shine away. Cousin Magnus had rickets and a bandy-legged gait. He would die soon, so he did not have to share his toys. But Nielsen's longing for the button became so great that one night when Magnus was sleeping, he crept in, unlatched the chest, and stole it. He walked about the darkened nursery for a while, fingering the thing, testing its weight, running his finger over the body of the fox, feeling the brass take on the warmth of his hand, until something overcame him, not remorse exactly, but a dawning fatigue, an emptiness, and he returned the button to the place where he had found it. Cousin Magnus never knew. Nobody knew. But for months and years and even decades afterwards, long after Cousin Magnus was dead, that theft was as a splinter in his heart. He saw the moonlit nursery every time he spoke his cousin's name. He blushed at nothing. He sometimes pinched himself or uttered an oath at the memory. For although a man is judged by his actions, by what he has said and done, a man judges himself by what he is willing to do, by what he might have said or might have done, a judgment that is necessarily hampered not only by the scope and limits of his imagination, but by the ever-changing measure of his doubt and self-esteem. "I estimate that it will be at least April before the sale is successfully repealed," Shepherd was saying, with the same perfect gravity. "In the meantime, immediately, in fact, I propose that you invest the entire sum of your commission into the building of my jailhouse." Nielsen raised his eyebrows in surprise.
"But the money is not mine," he said, for the second time that afternoon. "It has already been revoked de jure, if not de facto. Once the widow's appeal has been granted and the sale of the estate declared void, I shall have to pay my commission back in full."
"The council can sponsor your loan with interest," Shepherd said. "The jail is publicly funded, after all. By the time your commission is recalled, I will be able to draw down funds from the reserve and repay you. We shall have a contract drawn up. You may name your terms. Your investment will be secure."
"If you have public funding," Nielsen said, "then why propose this to me at all? What need do you have of these £400?
"Yours is ready money, and will be privately invested," Shepherd said. "My council funding has been approved, but not paid out. If I wait for the sum to be apportioned and deposited into the jail's account, I will be waiting for 30 bankers to push my contract across 30 desks and back again. It will be March or April, and the elections will be passed."
"And Lauderbeck will have his convicts," Nielsen said.
"Yes, and he will have siphoned off a great deal more of the district's budget besides."
"Very well," Nielsen said. "Let us suppose that I agree to this, and you get your jailhouse. You said that both of us would stand to gain."
"Well, yes," Shepherd said, blinking. "You will have employment, Mr. Nielsen. You will get your standard commission on the labour, and the iron, and the timber, and the nails, and every small thing.